The North Carolina Reading Service presents the following program for our blind or print-impaired listening audience. It's the Indie Week, the independent weekly journal read today by John Federson, and our edition is published on March the 12th of 2026. I've been away for a couple of weeks, and I'm back now with a full schedule of articles from Indie Week. The first one by Lisa Sorg from Inside Climate News, which is reprinted here. A global chemical giant racks up violations in Durham, where drinking water for a million is threatened. Brenntag Mid-South continues to amass serious environmental violations related to its chemical repackaging plant in East Durham, where state inspectors cited the company in November for failing to clean up leaking barrels on the property. Recent testing also shows a chemical cocktail continues to enter a neighborhood stream that runs behind an elementary school through a public park and flows into Third Fork Creek and Jordan Lake, the drinking water supply for more than a million people, according to the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality. City and state agencies have issued numerous violations to the billion-dollar company, but after more than 2 years of investigations, have yet to impose financial penalties. A spokesman for the NC Department of Environmental Quality told Inside Climate News the agency, quote, cannot comment on future enforcement actions, but it continues to work with Brenntag to receive data and ensure the completion of the actions required in last fall's notice of violation, including some items with deadlines this month and in May. The Durham Environmental Affairs Board is scheduled to discuss the issue at its meeting on March the 4th. This has already happened. Brenntag Mid-South is a global chemical distribution company that warehouses liquid and granular chemicals in bulk storage in Durham and repackages them for truck and rail shipments. Brenntag spokesperson Raquel Shepard did not answer direct questions about plant conditions and the company's efforts to keep chemicals from entering the stream. Instead, Shepard provided a written statement, quote, the issues affecting Third Fork Creek are complex and may be the result of multiple sources that are not yet known with certainty. While Brenntag Mid-South's operations are not the source of the site's historical contamination, Brenntag has consistently taken numerous steps in close coordination with the City of Durham to help address these issues, as documented in our quarterly reporting to and communications with the city. Brenntag's Mid-South is committed to collaboration in this investigative process and continues to expend internal and external resources and expertise in cooperation with local authorities. Close quote. Adid Ortiz, a community organizer who lives across from the plant, expressed her continuing concern. She said, it feels like this ominous danger that's lurking in my backyard. Brenntag has the money, and I wish they would do right by us. We know we have industrial uses around the corner, and none of us has ever made a fuss about them just existing, but we will make a fuss about you deliberately harming us when you know better. A DEQ inspector last September found steel drums outside that had, quote, fluids running down the sides with liquids accumulated on the top, according to state records. Quote, the drums that were found spilling chemicals onto the pallets brings into question how many other pallets kept on site have been contaminated. This was the third time state regulators discovered poor housekeeping at the plant. In April of 25, inspectors found rusted, dented, and leaking drums, although they had been removed by the fall site visit. In March, back in 2022, the state inspected the facility and found barrels of stored chemicals were lying on their side. Others were dented and, quote, an unknown liquid appeared to be leaking in the containment area. Even more alarming, say advocates, are the chemicals, some of them cancer-causing, that continue to enter the stream from the Brenntag property. Sampling by Brenntag contractors in December found more than a dozen chemicals, leaving an outfall at the property's southern boundary. Of those, three were detected above state regulatory or recommended levels, ethanol, and the likely carcinogens acetone and 1,4-dioxane, both solvents. A month later, in January, the Haw River Assembly, a nonprofit organization that monitors water quality in central North Carolina, sampled the creek behind Burton Elementary School, about 1,500 feet from Brenntag. That testing found levels of acetone 3,800 parts per billion, nearly twice the state maximum for surface water. The assembly detected another carcinogen, methylene chloride, at 124 parts per billion. The compound has multiple uses in degreasers, paint and adhesive removers, and cleaning agents. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has established a drinking water standard of 5 parts per billion for both acetone and methylene chloride. That's 5 versus 124, which were found. There is no surface water standard for methylene chloride in North Carolina, but New Jersey has set a maximum of 2 parts per billion. The compound has been found in surface waters at an average of 68 parts per billion at some hazardous waste sites, according to the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. The EPA has determined methylene chloride, which is a chemical used in consumer and commercial applications, including adhesives and sealants, automotive products, and paint, presents, quote, an unreasonable risk to human health because it is a neurotoxin that can also damage the liver. Breathing extremely high levels can be fatal. Regularly inhaling or touching the compound can increase the risk of developing cancer, according to the EPA. Brenntag's state air permit allows the company to emit over 1,600 pounds of methylene chloride each year. When Brenntag contractors sampled upstream of the school in December, they didn't detect methylene chloride. The discrepancy between these results and Haw River's could reflect a different laboratory detection methods. Even though it's unlikely that people drink water directly from the stream, children could inadvertently ingest it while playing. The stream runs behind Burton Elementary Playground and through McDougal's Terrace, the largest and oldest public housing community in Durham. And then it flows into Third Fork Creek, a tributary of Jordan Lake, the drinking water supply for more than a million people. State records show that the violations from last year included dark, discolored water flowing from the plant into the stream. These conditions, plus the presence of chemicals flowing from the property, quote, represents a potential risk for human health through contact with the water, as well as harm to aquatic life. Haw Riverkeeper Emily Sutton said the assembly would continue to test the creek with help from community groups. Quote, we're going to build the evidence that enforcement needs to happen, but we have to rely on our state agencies to hold them accountable through their permits and violations. Brenntag contractors only recently began to test for 1,4-dioxane, so December's results were the first to detect it. It's a likely carcinogen. 1,4-dioxane has contaminated several waterways and drinking water supplies in North Carolina, including the Haw, Deep, and Cape Fear rivers. The compound is found in solvents, degreasers, and even some consumer products. Levels of 1,4-dioxane ranged from 3.6 parts per billion at the property line of Brenntag to 1.5 in the stream at the Durham Freeway. The EPA set a health advisory goal to 0.35, that's less than 1 part per billion, in surface water that serves as a drinking water supply, and 80 PPB for non-drinking water supplies. Sutton said, these are very clear water quality violations, very clear groundwater violations, and it's ongoing. This is a bad actor, and they need to be held accountable. More than 2 years ago, in August of 2023, the city fenced off the stream after Brentag detected high levels of acetone, toluene, and ethanol in water at its property edge. The findings prompted the city to prohibit Brentag from discharging any runoff or other water from the site. Brentag collects the runoff in basins, then pays a company to haul it away. Since contaminants continue to flow into the stream, company contractors believe contaminated groundwater is circumventing the treatment system and entering the waterway. To try to isolate the source of the contamination, the company turned off the treatment system 2 years ago with DEQ permission, state records show. As recently as November, Arcadis, a contractor for the company, told DEQ in an email it had repaired recovery wells on plant property, but that Brentag had not given them approval to restart the system. For more than a century, polluting industries have been built near and in residential neighborhoods in East Durham, abetted by county and city zoning ordinances. Ortiz, a longtime resident, had this to say. My expectation was that each of these companies would act with respect and dignity to their neighbors. To find out that has not been the case, and that schools, homes, churches, and community groups have to endure the contamination is really disturbing. I just feel like East Durham just can't seem to catch a break. All right, we'll move to a couple politically related stories. First, North Carolina Senator Greg Meyer is going to resign. He's a Democrat serving Orange, Person, and Caswell, will leave the General Assembly at the end of this month to become a new executive director of the North Carolina Justice Center. Meyer, a veteran lawmaker who has served a combined 12 years in the NC House and the NC Senate, said he was ready for the next stage of public service. He told NC Newsline, politicians are really the receptacles of outside organizing power. If you really want change, you have to have communities that are organized and advocacy organizations that are communicating the intended change that you want your elected officials to enact. For 30 years, the North Carolina Justice Center has worked to eliminate poverty and ensure that every North Carolinian has the opportunity to thrive. Meyer, a leading voice for progressive causes, said the Raleigh-based nonprofit has the benefit of working across policy areas to help communities and elected officials understand how issues are interconnected. Quote, the Justice Center will continue to work on specific things like education policy, but also identify how they are attached to health policy, immigration policy, and economic policy, and advocate for moving the big levers that bring good changes for people across all policy levels. Meyer's resignation will be effective March the 31st. The Democratic Party's local executive committee has an internal process for identifying who will fill that seat and who will replace Meyer on the ballot for the November midterms. By law, Governor Stein must appoint the person that the party selects. That appointment will likely occur before the short legislative session. Meyer said there are many qualified people who could fill the seat, but he hopes that it will be someone who understands the three-county district, is willing to help support the party, and will speak boldly in challenging moments. For the first time in more than a decade, Meyer will find himself speaking outside the halls of the NC General Assembly. His departure comes at a time when the two chambers are divided on a comprehensive state budget and grappling with federal cuts that will impact Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Meyer believes the Justice Center can be a strong voice for progressive policy solutions, and that may involve some unlikely coalitions, he said, for instance, on housing, I think there's the possibility to build coalitions of people who traditionally have been on opposite sides of issues, but might actually have a shared interest in building more housing and more affordable housing in dense, connected communities. And where we're not able to get things done in the General Assembly, then we should be working at the local level. That might create some pressure for the General Assembly to do better, because they see it's possible, and people are starting to demand it. Another thorny challenge will be getting the Republican-controlled legislature to rethink a 2025 decision to freeze grants from the Interest on Lawyers Trust Accounts program, blocking the awarding of new IOLTA grants cuts off millions of dollars to groups like Legal Aid of North Carolina, Pisgah Legal Services, Disability Rights, NC, and the NC Justice Center. That fund also provided $900,000 to victims of Hurricane Helene in 2024 who needed legal aid after the natural disaster. At an October 2025 hearing, Representative Harry Warren, Republican of Rowan, accused the IOLTA board of going rogue and funding groups with leftist ideologies. Meyer said the litigation the Justice Center does behalf on working people is generally legal work that a for-profit firm won't do. Meyer said if people don't have the personal wherewithal to go up against someone in court who has more money than they do, they usually have to walk away from terrible situations. If no one fights those battles in court, we allow exploitation to go on, unchecked. Meyer said constituents in every district in the state benefit from the IOLTA funds. Quote, we can address the concerns that we've heard from the Speaker of the House and other legislators and still continue to provide services to people who need it. For now, these funds remain frozen until June 30th of 2026. In the last legislative session, Meyer introduced legislation that would increase reporting standards on school vouchers and increase transparency in the budget process, giving the public more notice before the state budget could be adopted. That bill would also remove legislative confidentiality from lawmakers requesting funding in the appropriations bill. Yet another bill of Meyer's would have made all redistricting documents public records. The move for greater accountability comes after legislators included in the state budget a provision to exempt themselves from the state's public records law. Some Democrats have expressed frustration that many of the bills they view as common sense have never once been debated by the majority party. Meyer understands that frustration, exacerbated by a toxic national political climate that's turning many people off. He says it's time for advocacy and policy organizations to strategically plan for a decade plus of progress. And he's urging progressives to avoid the trap of fighting hate with more hate. Quote, that's what I want to do with this next stage of my leadership. I want to help North Carolinians who really believe we should all take care of each other and support each other. Everyone should have the opportunities that the most fortunate among us have. And he begins work at the North Carolina Justice Center next month. Now, North Carolina primaries ended March 3rd, and after some suspense there, 4th Congressional District Representative Valerie Fouché is set for a third term in Congress. By the time the final precincts reported results around midnight, just 1,200 votes separated Fouché and her opponent, Durham County Commissioner Nida Alam. Alam initially said on election night that she would pursue a recount before she conceded the race the next day. The results don't exactly add up to a ringing endorsement of Fouché. She won 49.18% of the vote to Alam's 48%. Add in the 2.6 that went to the dark horse candidate Mary Patterson, and that's a majority of voters who did not pick Fouché. When Indy interviewed her in December, Fouché argued, quote, louder is not always better, and said, it is not, in my opinion, my role to elevate my work, using the biblical analogy of sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. But Alam's media-fluent campaign, that's a barrage of selfie Instagram videos, Reddit AMAs, clips of her children at a rally with Bernie Sanders, etc., drove the conversation around the election and framed it as a referendum on Fouché, leaving the incumbent to defend a congressional record that, in an era of Republican control, is thin. Perhaps because Alam put her on the defensive, Fouché ended up more vocally staking out some positions Alam had argued on the campaign trail that a representative for the super blue 4th Congressional District should take, like opposing a now dead data center proposal in Apex and causing for ICE to be dismantled. By one of her final campaign stops the weekend before the election, Fouché seemed to have shed some of her misgivings about self-promotion. She said, "I'm not one who talks a lot about myself, but it seems like in this race I have to remind people what I have done, because the lies that you all see incessantly on TV, they're lies." Nationally, the race drew attention and over $4.4 million in outside spending as a potential bellwether for the mood of Democratic voters in a second Trump era and a proxy battle over issues like diversity in Congress, Israel, and Gaza, and the role of corporations in politics. Would voters pick the more defiantly left-wing Alam or the measured, experienced Fouché? But with only a 1% vote margin, the bellwether seems a bit disoriented. The day after Alam conceded the race, we spoke to Fouché about her reflections on the campaign, the $1.5 million that the AI company Anthropic spent to support her re-election, and what residents should do now with all their political energy. Now, this interview article has been edited for length and clarity by Indy. Question and answer. Where were you when you saw the results? So I was in downtown Hillsboro at a small establishment that really has not done anything but soft opening. So I had family, of course, including one of my granddaughters, my pastor, other community members, several Orange County elected officials, and that was pretty much it. But because I wanted it to be smaller, most of mine have been, you know, I'm not one for fanfare, but it was nice. Do you feel you've learned anything in particular this cycle, or did the election change your perspective on anything? I think if there was any change in my perspective, it was pretty much on how politics run now, but I guess, Chase, a lot of it had to do with me still trying to do my job while I was campaigning. And, you know, we've had some really tense times here, so most of my attention went to my work, and now to see the president has fired Kristi Noem, yeah, I spent more time doing the work, than campaigning. I don't know that I would do anything differently that I learned except for, and I think you and I have talked about this before, how we reach people. And to a great extent, it seemed, at least from what I was hearing, people weren't aware of the work that I have done over a period of 3 years. So I probably would have done that differently in announcing the work that we've done and the work that has benefited the district. You won by a pretty slim margin, and between the votes for Alam and Patterson, a majority didn't vote for you. Do you see that as a message about behaving or moving differently in the future? I don't think so. I don't know that I would. I don't think that was a factor in how I behave as it relates to how I get out a message. And quite frankly, I don't know. Well, I'll just leave it at that. I don't think so. Do you feel having the primary pushed you to take some stances that you would rather not be so public about? I'm thinking, for example, about that Apex data center. You said it was a local decision. Then later you clarified you opposed it, but you didn't want to be, quote, a thorn in the side of local officials. I don't think so. I think when that data center question was first asked of me, I answered it from how I felt. And because there seemed to be some miscommunication and misinterpretation of that answer, I felt a need to clarify. And as it relates to data centers, I do believe that Congress is so far behind this that we haven't given any kind of guidance to local or state officials about what should or shouldn't happen. So the people who have been elected to make those decisions, yes, I respect them, and their responsibility, and I respect the voters for having chosen them, and so I don't think I would change that. Question. We've spoken a lot about corporate and outside funding before, but how should constituents view the outside funding from the PAC associated with Anthropic, which dropped $1.6 million on your behalf a week before the election? And how should they see that, especially in the context of your stances and your committee roles? So why are we talking about the funding that was received to my campaign versus other funding that came from outside sources? I think what I would like to say is that until we reverse Citizens United, we need to make sure that local or district issues are considered and determined by folk who live in the district. I have always believed that I am a representative that does represent the values of the district. I am not in favor of any outside group influencing the decisions that are made for a district. What I believe is that campaign financing, our system, is broken. It needs to be fixed. And until then, people will do what they believe is necessary. I don't collaborate with outside groups, and you all know that what I saw, and I tried my best not to look at any of them, what I saw was that there was groups that were not known to me. You know, I'd say, who's doing this? And it says, not paid for by any candidate or whatever. I didn't have anything to do with that. So again, I wish this had not been a nationalized race because this was about the 4th District. And I am again still proud of the donations that came to my campaign that were from donors in the state and my district in particular. I watched at forums and town halls as people kept asking you about the AIPAC funding from 2022. What's your case for why the Anthropic money shouldn't define your third term for people like AIPAC did? I'll go back to the statement I just made. I don't coordinate with outside groups. My work on AI has centered around establishing guardrails and holding large corporations accountable. And that hasn't changed. It will not change. I know it's too early, but have you thought at all about 2028 and what's in your future? I have not. I hope to be living then. But right now, Chase, what I think about most is where we are as a nation now, particularly as it relates to dismantling ICE, bringing down the cost of living, the war in Iran. I'm thinking about the fact that Democrats need the opportunity to govern, to show the American people that we care about all the issues that they care about. And so right now, most important to me is taking back the majority of the U.S. House of Representatives, because until then, we're not going to be able to make the impacts on daily living we want to, and what the American people are asking for. You know, the truth is, I left my watch party at around midnight or 12:30. I didn't get to sleep till after 3:30. First thing Wednesday morning, I was on a plane coming back to D.C., so I'd be here for voting, so I haven't had a chance to think about much else. Question. Then there was all this energy, of course, around campaigning in the primary. Especially in this very blue district, what can people do now with all that energy if they're worried about the Trump administration and all the things you've mentioned? What they should be worrying about is making sure we elect Roy Cooper to the U.S. Senate, that we get Anita Earls back on the North Carolina Supreme Court, that we help the North Carolina legislature elect members to that body to ensure we are moving forward to, for one thing, getting rid of how we redistrict every 2 years. Final question. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you think is important about this election, your tenure, or anything at all? Well, I would just like to say how honored I am and humbled that so many people believe I should be representing them in Congress. And for people who would have wanted someone else to be that representative, I would just want them to know I will continue to serve their best interest, as I've done over the last 3 years. Next, affordable housing tax loophole threatens to drain local government budgets. A growing number of apartment complex owners in Wake County and elsewhere in the state are taking advantage of a state law that grants property tax exemptions to nonprofits that provide affordable housing to low and moderate income residents, say Wake County officials. In a scheme that one longtime affordable housing developer refers to as a, quote, rent a nonprofit structure, for-profit apartment complex owners can hand over fractions of ownership to nonprofits to qualify for generous tax exemptions. The move can result in significant reductions in property tax values for cities and counties, sometimes tens of millions of dollars. Wake County Tax Administrator Marcus Kinrid told county commissioners during a recent meeting, "This is a huge leak in your tax base and the city of Raleigh's also. Most of these things are occurring in the city, so it's affecting them even worse than the county." Lower tax values means less revenue for counties to fund schools, libraries, public safety, and health, human services, which can force local governments to reduce services or raise taxes. Exemptions in Wake County have nearly doubled from 66 exemptions in 2020 to 136 last year, said Kinrade. The exemptions for low and moderate income housing account for a projected reduction in taxable property value, $776 million reduction, the equivalent of a $4 million revenue loss. And he said, "This, in my opinion, is the biggest threat to the revenue stream in this county that I could ever imagine." This year, the county received about 170 applications for exemptions before the February 1st deadline. The taxable value of these properties is $1.2 billion, which would result in a loss of $6 million in county tax dollars, said Kinrad. "Wake County is not alone when it comes to losing taxable value this way. Cities and counties across the state are having billions of dollars worth of formerly taxable properties wiped from the tax rolls as a result of this loophole in state law." The law was adopted in 2010 to help increase the supply of low and moderate income housing by giving owners a break on property taxes. Such housing generally offers rents at or below 80% of area median income. It was created in 2013 when the Court of Appeals ruled that Cane Creek Village, a low-income housing project in Mitchell County, owned by a for-profit limited liability company but controlled by a nonprofit, was entitled to a property tax exemption. The nonprofit in that case, Northwestern Housing Enterprises Incorporated, owned 0.1% of Blue Ridge Housing, which held title to the property. A for-profit partnership, North Carolina Equity Fund III Limited Partnership, owned 99.9% of Blue Ridge Housing. Although the loophole has existed since 2013, Kinrad said apartment owners began to take advantage of it in greater numbers starting in 2023 after several law firms and real estate brokers began marketing it to apartment owners. "Properties receiving exemptions are generally older apartment complexes," said Kinrad. "Because of their age and conditions, owners can rent them to tenants earning 80% of area median income or less. 80% of area median income or less is generally accepted as a standard for low and moderate income housing." An analysis by Durham-based Self-Help, a nonprofit developer and lender that coined the rent a nonprofit phrase, estimates that 94% of multifamily units in Wake County could eventually be exempted from property taxes because they provide rents at 80% of area median or below. "If Self-Help's analysis proves true," said Kinrid, "the amount of property removed from the county's tax base would cost $140 million in revenue." And he said, "Just doing a little work on the ownership structure can qualify these properties for full exemption based on the Blue Ridge housing model." To illustrate how the loophole works, Kinrad used the village at Broadstone Station Apartments in Apex, which was built in 2013. The apartment's website bills it as a luxury apartment community. Kinraid said the owner paid property taxes until 2024 when the apartments were sold to an investment group in Beverly Hills, California, for $66 million that year. He said that investment firm partnered with an Oregon nonprofit called the Foundation for Affordable Housing and used the loophole to qualify for a property tax exemption. Kinraid said, to my knowledge, they didn't change the rents. The rents are the same as they were prior to the purchase. It just so happens, because incomes are high in Wake County, 80% of median income is pretty high, too. North Carolina Newsline was unable to reach that foundation or the complex's owners for comment. County leaders' concerns have gotten the attention of lawmakers. State Representative Aaron Paré, Republican of Wake, has pledged to work to close the loophole, saying in a social media post, closing the loophole will recover foregone revenue, that's tax revenue lost, that would otherwise go to funding schools and other essential services. Paré co-chairs the House Select Committee on Property Tax Reduction and Reform that House Speaker Destin Hall created to review the factors contributing to rising local property taxes and to identify ways to reduce the burden on homeowners. In January, Self-Help told the House Select Committee on Property Tax Reduction that property tax exemptions for affordable housing are critical to alleviating the housing crisis, but the current wording of the law is too vague, ripe for abuse, and, quote, deviates from the original spirit. Self-Help recommended lawmakers require qualifying properties to be 100% nonprofit owned and operated as affordable housing. It also wants properties to have federal, state, and local government financial support, long-term affordability restrictions, and nonprofit general partner with control, and a long-term ownership option. The North Carolina Association of County Commissioners made similar recommendations to the committee, but also said the state should require an annual application process in which owners would report the number of low-income units it has in an apartment complex. Kinraid said lawmakers must change the law to clearly define low- and moderate-income housing, saying, we're not against affordable housing, but we want it to be in the classical form of affordable housing and not this rent-a-nonprofit structure. We think it's just taking advantage of taxpayers. He said there must be more oversight to ensure owners who receive exemptions provide housing to residents earning 80% or less. There's really no ability, he said, to ensure that the residents who are receiving these rents qualify based on their income unless the tax office gets in the business of auditing these properties every year, which is going to strain our resources. Finally, State Senate Leader Phil Berger has also formed a committee to take a look at property tax concerns. Next, the Wake County Library System. They are eyeing nearby community garden site for Athens Drive replacement of that library branch. It wants to replace Athens Drive Community Library in Southwest Raleigh with a new building across the street on the site of the well-fed community garden. The board agreed at a Monday work session. That's good news for library patrons and community members who have been advocating for more than a year to keep the replacement site local. Wake County's $142 million library bond package passed in 2024 includes money to replace Athens Drive Community Library, which is currently located within Athens Drive Magnet High School. That cohabitation has created security concerns for the school and led to a stark reduction in the library's hours. With the school slated for renovation beginning this summer, county staff have been searching for other locations to relocate the community library. Throughout the search, Athens Drive patrons urged the county to keep their library as close to the site as possible, citing its walkability, proximity to transit, and accessibility to a dense, growing, racially and economically diverse neighborhood. The area is close to North Carolina State University, the State Farmers Market, and the Beltline. The Community Garden Center site is less than a quarter mile away from the existing library, just a few minutes' walk down Athens Drive. Its 2.5-acre size is smaller than is typical for a community branch, meaning the new library building would probably need to be 2 stories tall. Deputy County Manager Ashley Jacobs told the commissioners, "It will be difficult and expensive to develop, but it is entirely possible to build a library there." And if you don't recall this, the site is owned by Arthur and Anya Gordon, the retired former owners of the Irregardless restaurant. Last year, the Gordons tried to rezone the community garden parcel for affordable housing, but they later withdrew their application. According to staff, the Gordons are asking $1.8 million for the property, which a county appraisal values at $1.2 million. That's a $600,000 difference, giving the commissioners pause. "I feel uncomfortable with paying more than the appraised value," said one commissioner. "I don't fully agree with putting more money, public dollars, in the pocket of a private owner." Still, Jackson and the other commissioners seemed to prefer to keep the library in its current neighborhood, as advocates have requested. Their other options, a 12-acre property nearly 3 miles away in Cary, owned by Wake County Public School System, or a standalone building in the renovated Athens Drive Magnet High School campus. The Cary option is located in a wealthier, less diverse neighborhood that is less accessible by foot and public transit than the community garden site. County staff said Athens Drive High School option would be prohibitively expensive at $33 to $35 million, requiring the cancellation of other library bond projects. County staff said they considered over 100 other potential sites for the library, but most were either unavailable, too far from the current site, or too small. They offered the commissioners an option to defer the decision by a year, but nobody wanted to. Commissioner Shanika Thomas said, "We could lose the opportunities we currently have on the table. But the other thing is that we have a finite amount of money and we are currently, despite the sunshine outside, a country at war. The gas prices went up 50 cents just last week. In waiting another year, when we talk about construction costs, we talk about tariffs, we talk about materials, that could be a large burden for us to assume." The commissioners ultimately asked County Manager David Ellis to attempt to negotiate the Gordons down to a lower purchase price. Ellis said he would come back to them in about a month with the couple's answer. Staff said that once Athens Drive Library is relocated to a standalone building with normal hours, for example, it's currently open only 35 hours a week, compared to the other library's 61, they expect many more people to begin using it. And Jacob said, "We are really underserving the community with a library being in the school because it's not open when the school is open." I guess that means it's not open when the school... That's right, it doesn't serve at the same time. Hannah McKenzie, who lives on Athens Drive and is a member of the Friends of Athens Drive Community Library Advocacy Group, told Indy last year the library's walkability, bikeability, and proximity to Go Raleigh bus stop are what makes it such a valuable community space. Neighbors have staved off several past attempts to shutter the library. And she said, "We want the library to be a safe place for kids, something they can walk to. We want the folks in the community who don't have access to personal vehicles to be able to access the library. That's what makes it unique. We're hitting big swaths of this really diverse population. That's what we would like to see again. If they put the library here, we'll be able to see that vibrancy again." Okay, Next, have you heard of the Boom Club? It's a home for electronic music nerds and novices alike. Inside Boom Club, the atmosphere is tranquil. Synthesizers and keyboards line the walls of a space with a low static hum that flows through the air like a siren call, beckoning visitors to explore the unlimited sonic potential of the electronic instruments on display. Durham's Build Our Own Music, that's Boom Club, founded by Rochelle Sicarat, Nick Williams, and Sean Thegan, is as much for the novice as for the nerd. Unlike traditional instruments, the machines in the space don't require years of music theory or even an understanding of scales or pitch. To start, just press a button or twist a knob and see where the sound waves lead you. The first iteration of Boom debuted as a one-day pop-up event at the Fruit in fall of 2024. Williams said the club moniker is more after-school AV club than country club. He wants Boom Club to be a place where freaky, semi-disreputable, but open-hearted people can come and leverage the space's resources to learn and experiment with all kinds of music and be part of an inclusive music community. He said, it's really hard to be a professional musician. It's almost impossible for most people, and we can't really change that, but we can create a place where people can be seen and appreciated and part of a local musical culture. Because once you're part of something like that, nothing feels better in the world. It feels so good to be a building block in a local culture. The space opens at 600 Foster Street, inside the space formerly occupied by PS37, on March the 6th. It offers day passes and long-term memberships for folks to access the instrument library. Higher tiers include tutorials and workshops, as well as entry into Boom Club events. Aspiring Triangle area musicians can apply for discounted and free memberships. Last summer, Boom Club set up in a defunct train car at the American Tobacco campus, affectionately called Electric Choo Choo, with dozens of synths for passers-by to experiment with. Acclaimed artists like Susie Analog, great name, also hosted workshops on the craft of making electronic music as well as its history and subcultures. Recently, the team hosted a Modular 101 workshop in Durham and at NC State. Boom Club's new space will allow them to expand these offerings, with artists already lined up to provide expertise. Sicarat has spent much of her career curating art as a public art coordinator with the city of Durham and as an event promoter. Several years ago, she decided she wanted to experiment with music, but accessing the gear, which can cost hundreds if not thousands of dollars, was a barrier to entry. Founding Boom Club was her way of breaking down those barriers for herself and others. And she said, when I was thinking this through, before we started, I was like, that would be great for me too. And it has been. This is a place where I've learned so much and continue to learn what I want to do with these instruments. She serves as a kind of gadget translator of sorts for other folks who come to Boom Club with a little technical knowledge, or with very little, helping guide visitors from a place of equal footing. When someone comes in, I say, feel free to just play with it. Let's explore this together right now. Now, a majority of the synths and keyboards belong to the Boom Club team, with a few vintage instruments also on loan from Alex Maiolo, a Chapel Hill native and longtime friend of Thegan and Williams. Unbeknownst to Maiolo, who recently moved to San Francisco, his gear might have found a new permanent home. This is a good time to announce we're never going to give it back, Thegan jokes. Thegan and Williams are veteran performers in the local music scene. Williams was one of the original co-founders of the Pinhook in 2008 and has played in numerous bands around the Triangle. Thegan hosted his own radio show on WHUP from 2015 to 2017 and performs as a DJ and musician under the moniker Ultra Billions. The two men met at a concert over a decade ago. Deacon said he couldn't help but notice Williams' F-Buttons band shirt and was surprised to meet another fan of the obscure British electronic duo. Their interests are shared by a flourishing electronic music scene, one which was particularly robust a decade ago, Roundhouse, a Durham-based DJ collective and music label, home to a roster of elite sample mixers, button mashers, and knob twisters, emerged in 2016 as one of the forerunners during that creative boomlet. Artists from the label routinely performed on stage at music and technology festival Moogfest, which relocated from Asheville to Durham in 2015 before it halted in 2019. The festival's four-year run gave Triangle artists an elevated platform to showcase skills for an international audience. Now, this is my personal insertion here. Moogfest, you may or may not know the Moog synthesizer, one of the early pioneers of analog synthesizers, was formed a company in Asheville, North Carolina. And in fact, in downtown Asheville, there is a Moog synthesizer museum, which has more than just the Moog instruments, which are, by the way, still manufactured in various forms. I trained on one back in music school that filled a room. It was one of the full-size ones. Everything was a patch cord. And it was fun as anything, although I never did anything with it. So this equipment is not the kind of little keyboards you see that make everything sound like a pig. These can be organized to provide immense variety and a palette of sound. And they're easy to play or easy to fool with anyway, let's put it that way. Okay, back to the article. On a recent Saturday afternoon, Boom Club and Roundhouse teamed up for a friendly beat-making competition before launching into the 10th anniversary party later that night. Co-founder Nick Wallhauser and Thiegen previously collaborated on a series called Micro Machines. He called Boom Club's move into the old space a perfect fit. They're trying to cultivate a community and give it a home base for people to come and experiment and have access to things. Music, like any other subculture, can be intimidating to those on the outside looking in. Boom Club was founded to defuse any air of exclusivity, as well as to reshape notions of what electronic music is. My real dream would be some 12-year-old comes in, samples a mini Moog on their iPhone, and makes music we've never heard of. Deegan said, added he wants to get rid of some of that barrier of what electronic music is. Last time I checked, he said, any recorded music involves microphones and electronics, so unless you're playing a banjo in a forest, you are involved in electronic music. He imagines many of the folks who visit that synthesizer clubhouse won't necessarily be aspiring full-time musicians, but also hobbyists and enthusiasts, nurturing their creativity. And he said, you don't have to be a professional musician as your goal. I like to play basketball. I'm not trying to make it to the NBA. It doesn't mean I don't enjoy it. Great article. And I'll just say again that it opens at 600 Foster Street in Durham. I can excerpt my final article from March the 2nd, I wasn't here to read Indy, about a new bar in Durham called SWAF, at least I'm going to say that is, S-O-I-F, on West Main Street. It opened in early this month. We'll serve coffee during the day, cocktails and spritzers at night. So in the few minutes I have left, I'll say on behalf of the author, Lena Geller, a few years ago, my 2006 Camry stopped playing music from my phone. While this initially felt devastating, I quickly came to appreciate the experience of relying on the same 10 CDs. Infinite options are nice. Sometimes it's better just to have the edit. Something of this idea is at work at SWAF, a new downtown Durham coffee shop, meat bar in that its postage stamp size at 600 square feet is ruled out most permutations of what kind of bar it could be, leaving what's there pared down and sharper for it. On West Main Street, we'll serve coffee during the day and flip to spritzers and cocktails at night. It's the latest spot from Jesse Gerstle, who also owns Natural Wine Bar Delafia in South Roxborough. Housed in a narrow chamber off the lobby of the Snow Building, a 1930s Art Deco building with offices on the floors above, Swaff is intimate to the point that setting up a laptop might feel like projecting a presentation to the room. Therefore, it does not have Wi-Fi. There's limited space behind the bar for a spread of bottles and pumps. Therefore, Swaff offers basic espresso drinks without a range of flavored syrup options. That's not to say it's austere. Swaff has the vibe of a place you duck into when you want your day to feel slightly more cinematic. A checkered black and cream tile floor, tiered glass pendant lights, 13 seats, a standing rail, and a couple of tables out in the lobby. It's not trying to be the highest-end cup in Durham, and Gerstel said prices will reflect that. In the evening, the menu will shift from coffee to non-alcoholic cocktails, low ABV drinks built around sherry, vermouth, and other aperitifs, and three full-strength cocktails, three, a Manhattan, a Negroni, and a martini. The wine list will include one white, one red, and one sparkling. Gerstel told me he found the space first and worked the concept around it. What made sense, he decided, was something modeled after coffee bars where he grew up in Italy, where the bar is the center of the community, and everyone starts their day standing at the counter talking about sports or politics or whatever is going on around town. And that will have to break things off, and as the music fades in, John Federson for Indie Week. Again, these articles, there's much more to this article. It can all be found at indieweek.com, which is accessible on the Internet. I don't believe there's even a subscription fee for it. You can read articles and more. This is the publication that includes the Best of the Triangle awards that come out every year. Well, thank you very much for rejoining our broadcast. This program itself will be a podcast after Friday when it's our first broadcast of the piece. Then it will be in our podcast section from, you guessed it, the North Carolina Reading Service. And all of us here, and there's just me right now, thank you very much for listening to us again from ncreadingservice.org.